Welcome to Smart Habits for Translators, a podcast for translators by translators, bringing you simple strategies to build better habits. In each episode, we'll focus on specific habits for translators in various stages of their careers. If you're a translator who enjoys learning about habits to improve your business and lifestyle, then this is the podcast for you. We're your hosts, Madalena Sanchez-Zampalo
and Veronica De Michelis. Like you, we are professional freelance translators trying to balance the challenges that come with building a career and maintaining clarity and boundaries between work and personal life. We hope you'll join us in this conversation about smart habits and discover some simple strategies you can apply today to help you build your career and achieve the lifestyle you desire. Welcome to Smart Habits for Translators. This is episode 55. Today's episode is all about the importance of checking and improving our work as translators. We all know that this is a crucial step in maintaining the high quality of our work, but not all of us enjoy the editing and proofreading step or have a systematic and efficient approach to doing this. So to discuss this topic, we invited two of our colleagues who we know are not only excellent translators, but also talented editors. We're excited to welcome Yves Badeux and Emily Safran to the podcast. Yves Badeux is a 20-plus year veteran of the language services industry and has worn many hats. She's an ATA-certified French-to-English translator focusing on the translation of corporate communications, market research, and international development content. She also has multilingual project management expertise. Yves is the author of Maintaining Your Second Language, Practical and Productive Strategies for Translators, Teachers, Interpreters, and Other Language Lovers. She sponsors an online book club for translators called the Global Reads Book Club, which focuses on books in translation. She has graduate degrees from both the University of Lorraine, Nancy II in France, and the University of Virginia in the US. She currently serves on the board of directors of the American Translators Association.
And Emily Safran is a bilingual editor and ATA-certified Spanish-to-English translator who specializes in the culinary and medical sectors. Her clients include food media company Eater and large pharmaceutical companies. She has also edited numerous books, both monolingual and translated. Emily has lived between the U.S. and Spain for nearly 20 years and earned her master's degree in intercultural communication and public service translation and interpreting from the Universidad de Alcalá in 2014. She's the owner of Safran Translations. Welcome, Emily and Yves.
Thanks.
Thank you.
We're so happy that you could join us today. So let's just jump right in, and I'll start with you, Emily, and ask you to tell our listeners about your translation business and when and how you started in your freelance career, and how it's evolved over time.
So as far as when my freelance career started, while I was doing my master's degree in Spain, I had some professional experience doing a couple of internships. One of them was interpreting for non-Spanish speaking immigrants in Madrid for the public health department, and also as a translator for the Spanish Department of Justice. So that, you know, that work was similar to freelancing, but wasn't paid, of course. And then once I graduated, I started freelancing full time and quickly realized that I wasn't going to be able to pay the bills just freelancing right off the bat. So I took a part-time job in-house as an interpreter at a healthcare organization in Portland, Oregon, which is where I still live today. And then did freelancing on the side and tried to build up my freelance business. And while I was doing that, I ended up taking another role as a language services coordinator at the same organization and was their lead interpreter and translator for 7 clinics around the region. And by the end of 2017, I finally had enough freelance work that I was, even at my part-time job, I was, you know, having to respond to emails and calls for my freelance business during lunch and during work breaks, and it just became too much. So I went full-time freelance at that point and started out in the medical sector because that was where I had the most experience. And from there, started doing culinary translation a few years ago because that's really where my greatest passion lies. And after I could make this story even longer, but to keep it short, I ended up including copy editing as a service a few years into my freelance career. And now those are the
Very
three things
cool.
I offer now.
Great. And we have the connection to Alcalá de Henares because that's where I spent a semester. And we realized we both went to school there.
That's right. So, I love that.
Yeah. Very cool. And what about you, Eve? Can you tell us about your translation business and how you started and how your business has evolved over time?
Yeah, I was going to take a little bit different tack from Emily. And I was just going to say, I started working freelance in, are you guys ready? 1999.
That's a great year.
Yeah. Yeah, we did have a fun party that year for New Year's, right? Yeah.
Right.
So I started doing that after I'd worked for two agencies on the management side. And I actually have these funny memories of myself working in this apartment that my husband and I lived in downtown. We thought we were hip, you know. It was kind of cool. And I can picture myself, you know, in this apartment that we had. And I remember getting, you know, checks, literally getting checks in francs.
Oh, wow.
From French clients. You know, we did use the internet back then, but yeah, but the checks, it was just a lot different. Maybe that's one of the reasons too, like how much the payment methods have changed over the years, where, you know, sometimes I talk and present on payment methods, kind of interesting. But I had worked for two agencies on the management side. And so I just thought, like, you know, hey, this is a cool industry, but I want to take it a different direction. And I want to do this certain things on my own and kind of be able to, you know, shape my own path and my own reputation. My reputation was really important to me, and like everybody's, but I wanted to have kind of be able to control that more than working for someone else. I wanted to work for myself to be able to do that. So when you said how's it evolved, I kind of took the tact of looking at it in those decades that have passed. As you guys can imagine, there's been a lot of changes since then for me personally and for the industry. And I think I would say that the biggest change, obviously, for the industry and life in general, too, is the evolution of technology and new ways of working and new ways of having technology help us get our jobs done. And so, and when I say that, I don't necessarily just mean machine translation at all, because it's changed a lot. And I mean in all areas, like how do we carry out the administrative tasks we need to do? How do we do research when we're actually translating? What kind of translation tools are there? You know, really, that's the technology has affected since that time all these areas of our professional lives. And yeah, so that was the big thing that came to mind with that question. And then, as you mentioned earlier, I've worked as both a translator and I work as both a translator and a project manager. And I think that in both areas since that time, competition has increased and the importance of differentiating yourself has really grown. And so the internet, as I just said, has made a lot of things easier, but it's also, maybe in a bad way, made the barriers to entry easier for anyone who wants to hang up a shingle, and it makes it harder, I think, for clients to wade through all those options that are out for them. So that's changed a lot too. And so I think one thing that's changed in all that time that's related to that is that it is really important than ever to differentiate yourself and to focus on a particular niche or specialty than it was when I started out freelancing.
Interesting. Well, that kind of goes into our second question, and that is, what are some smart habits that have been crucial in your career, maybe related to work or physical and mental health, relationships? And I think that, you know, you just sort of named one about differentiating yourself. Eve, do you have any others?
So I had two things that I want to talk about particular to that. So kind of that's nice that you asked that, because kind of just one of them is, again, throughout my career, it's always been really important to me to keep my reputation in mind. And I know that sounds like, well, duh, or like everybody does that. But I do think that if you're really thinking about that, that you do react differently in how you interact with clients and how you interact with colleagues.
Right.
And so on one hand, I've always striven to meet or exceed client expectations. I'm always looking for ways to improve efficiency. How can I provide an initial service? How can I provide a higher quality product? How can I use that new technology, you know, to keep doing that? And also more the perspective of when I first went out on my own, my reputation was, you know, hey, I don't necessarily like the way that the agency, you know, it's okay overall, but there's certain thing they're presenting this certain way. I'm uncomfortable with that. And I want to have a lot of integrity in the way I do my business. And so throughout my career, I've always kept that in mind, like, you know, would I want someone doing this to me? Would I, you know, just that kind of thing, like integrity with colleagues and integrity with clients. So that's a big thing that I've always kind of felt like is crucial. And I do feel like it has made me stand out. Not that everybody else doesn't have integrity, but I just mean, I think that people, when they think of me, I hope, you know, think of that, they think of, respect me in that way. So I hope that I've been successful with that. Then from a slightly different standpoint, from a physical perspective throughout my career, I've always thought that it's really important to get the tools that we need to do our job right. And specifically, I'm talking here about, I've always thought it's important to create a pleasant office environment and one that is ergonomically set up. You know, we work all day long in front of a computer, and it's important for our physical safety and our health to make sure that we have the office set up the right way. And that's one thing that I've always felt like throughout the years, like I've been willing to invest in, you know, a good computer and different equipment, whatever, so that we, so we can actually do our job and feel good about it and not be like hurting ourselves physically at the same time. So I wanted to go through some of the things I had noted down about that. So
yeah.
One is, you know, have a true dedicated office space in your home or a space that you rent. You know, don't just think like people say, like, I can be at the kitchen table, blah, blah, blah. You know, really think about to yourself, where do I want to have a dedicated office space, wherever that might be. To go ahead and decorate it so that you're happy, feeling that you like being in that space, that it's a positive place for you to be. And then specifically related to ergonomics, I think, like, you know, go ahead and purchase that ergonomic keyboard or purchase the keyboard that works best for you. Like I've tried ergonomic ones that are sold as ergonomic, but what I actually like is the chiclet keyboards. So whatever works, you know, for you to feel, make you feel like it's ergonomic for your own needs. So I don't actually buy quote an ergonomic keyboard, but I buy like those ones that it takes very little pressure to press them because it makes my hands hurt if I feel like I have to press hard. So whatever
right.
works for you.
Okay.
Yeah. Then purchase an ergonomic desk. So one that's really the correct height so that you have that, you know, the correct angle when you're typing. And so that could be one that's just set at the correct height. It's set at the correct height or one that moves up and down. So I have an electronic one, but I know there's manual ones out there too. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, don't skim, purchase a good mouse, purchase large enough monitors, or I know some people use multiple monitors. Make sure you have appropriate lighting in your office. Make sure you have an appropriate office chair that's adjustable. And then, you know, purchase other equipment that helps you be more ergonomic. Like some people like voice dictation tools. I don't really use those, but I know that to me is like an ergonomic tool.
Mm-hmm.
You know, don't, I guess my whole list I'm giving here is the idea of invest in yourself and don't skimp. And I think that's important for your career to be successful, where you really need to have the tools to do your job right. So another one of those would be, you know, purchase CAT tools as you need or other software, things that help you automate various repetitive tasks. And then one thing I wanted to mention was make sure you drink enough water. So that's part of my office setup. I always have a hydro flask that's sitting in my office because it's particularly dry in Colorado. But I think all of us need to drink more water than we think. So I always have, like, I have a pink hydro flask. I have a green one. I have a yellow one. Which one do I want to use today? Oh, that one's dirty. I can use the other one. So I think that's part of it too, about keeping ourselves healthy while we're working and not getting so involved in things. And I just have it right in front of me. So then I move my eyes around my office and there's my bottle of water. I guess I better take a drink.
Yeah.
So I was just thinking that's something that really has been, I think, something that's contributed to my career, having this pleasant place that I like working and I have the right tools that make working, you know, make it so that it's something, the whole action of working is pleasant too.
Oh, those are great tips. Yeah, I agree. And I mean, I'm one who doesn't drink enough water if I get busy. So I think that's a really good tip, especially just to make sure your space is set up, you know, to make you do your best at your work as well. What about you, Emily? What are some smart habits that have been crucial in your career? And it could be anything related to work, physical, mental health, relationships, or anything else.
Yeah, I have some things I want to mention. But before I do, I just want to say for anyone who has trouble drinking enough water, I highly recommend getting a bottle with a straw, because for me, that was life changing. I always drink a lot of water, but there's something about drinking, like sipping from a straw, that just makes it so easy and pleasurable to drink water throughout the day. And I have a mm-hmm. bottle someone gave me as a gift from a brand called Ello Products, ELLO. I am not any sort of affiliate with them, but I just really like my bottle and I've bought it as a gift for other friends. So anyone who needs to drink more water, that's a great way to do it. It makes it fun.
I think that's a totally awesome tip. I feel like that too, that it makes, especially at dinner, I'll be like, I need my straw.
Yeah.
Well, and I feel like you drink faster that
exactly.
way when you have a straw.
Exactly.
And also we should specify though for our listeners, I have a reusable straws. I do not use
yes.
straws that we throw away and put in the landfill.
Yeah.
I'm sure Emily does too.
Yeah, these come with right. reusable straws. And I actually have a hydro flask too, even. I love it. Just to put that out there. But I often choke when I drink, like when I'm really thirsty and I drink water out of a regular thermos or a glass, so that's why the straw is so fun.
Cool.
And
I think I just pour water down the front of my shirt because I'm
exactly,
trying to drink it too fast.
Exactly, that or I choke on it, yeah. So the straw makes it a lot easier. And then also wanted to just reiterate what Eve said about ergonomics. That was a huge changing point. I didn't intend to mention this, but it was a huge changing point in my freelance career, just getting my office set up and to be more ergonomic, because I injured my hip when I used to be on a dragon boat team. And ever since then, I just can't sit for very long. And I went through this whole journey of looking for ways to be comfortable while I worked. And that led to a sit stand desk and a ergonomic, like little bouncy stool that I use instead of a regular chair. And anyway, I actually wrote an article about ergonomics for translators and for the ATA exam, specifically for the ATA Chronicle a few years
yes.
ago. So maybe we can link to that in the show notes for anyone who's interested in hearing
yeah.
more of those tips, especially anyone who's studying for the exam. I think it's so important to be comfortable when we work, especially when we're under pressure like we are during the exam. So
mm-hmm.
that's my two cents on what you've said. But the smart habit I wanted to share was that's also been huge for me is pausing. So I like thinking of it as a pause rather than a break. And I think that comes from this book I read called Do Pause, You Are Not a To-Do List by Robert Poynton. And one of my yoga teachers recommended this book to me, and it just really resonated with me because the author talks about the concept of pause in all of life, not just in work, not just a break from work, but pausing before you walk in your front door to just clear your mind from the day, or going on a retreat to just gain a new perspective on your life or your work. And he talks about how, I believe it's Bill Gates, I could be wrong, but I think it's Bill Gates who takes a yearly or maybe biannual pause retreat where he just goes. And I think the idea is to not have any, he doesn't necessarily have any tasks planned, but he just takes a break and takes a pause and thinks about other things. And that helps him come up with new ideas or new perspectives on his work and his business. And anyway, there's a whole lot more in that book, but I just have found that taking a real pause from work is so important for me. And not only a pause from work, but kind of a pause from doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been on this, I've been exploring the idea the past couple of years of where the line exists between being productive and truly resting. And I think for a long time, I was taking breaks from work where I would say, okay, I'm going to go for a walk. And on my walk, I'm going to go to the store and pick up some onions for dinner. And, you know, then I would power walk to the store and power walk home and think I was getting a break. And then I would come home and be just as exhausted and not fresh to continue working.
Mm-hmm.
And it occurred to me that in talking to a friend, it occurred to me that that isn't actually a break, because you're still doing something productive, even if it's not related to work, and you're in this work mode, this productivity mode. And so I started incorporating 10-minute mindful walks into my workday instead of, you know, my quote unquote break of rushing to the store. And so I just, it's a shorter walk, but I just walk around a couple blocks by my apartment. And on the walk, I try to use my five senses and, you know, feel my feet on the ground and the breeze on my skin and, you know, look at the flowers and smell whatever smells there are, all of those things. And I find that just those 10 minutes of doing, you know, essentially nothing, but also being mindful, just really clears my mind so much better than taking a walk to go somewhere in particular.
That's so helpful. I think I heard somebody say once before, doing nothing can be productive. So
absolutely. Yes. That is exactly the mindset shift I've had to make over the past couple years, is that resting is productive. Sitting on the couch staring out the window is productive. And I've really struggled to accept that idea. But I'm coming to integrate it more and more into my belief system.
Emily, that's so interesting to me because that you say this, because I kind of, not as consciously as you, but I've been realizing that this last month, even I was thinking on the weekend, I was thinking, I'm going to do all this stuff. And then I thought, no, I'm not. I don't want to do anything. I mean, the idea of what you're saying, where I went to an outdoor concert. But at first I was like, okay, I got to go to Costco. I got to do this. I got to do this. And then I just thought like, ugh, you know, it was too much after the busy work week too. And just like you said, I was conscious, some more subconsciously, but realizing like, I just want to go and like go to this concert and sit outside. Or, you know, take a walk at the lake or whatever. So that's really interesting to me that you had that so mindfully, like you said. Thank you.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear you. Yeah, you had that wonderful thought too. Yeah.
I love it. I've been taking notes, and so much of what you said, Emily, resonates with me as well. Shifting gears a little bit, we really enjoyed your session at this year's ATA annual conference. And the title of your session was Proofread Like a Pro and Ship It Express, Effective and Efficient Quality Control for the Time-Strapped Language Professional. All of us, basically. We also know that you both, in addition to being excellent translators, are great editors and proofreaders. So tell us a little bit about the topic of your conference session and why it's important to you. Let's start with you, Emily.
Yeah, so I would say that the topic arose because Eve and I both had a personal and professional interest in editing techniques, and we were finding that we were both attending a lot of ACES sessions, the Society for Editing, and I know Madalena has been at a lot of those sessions too.
Yes, I love ACES.
Yeah, I can't remember if I've seen you at any of them, Veronica, but for anyone who isn't familiar with ACES, they're fantastic and they really dovetail well with ATA and translation techniques and tools and all of that. So anyway, Eve and I were attending all of these ACES sessions at the same time, and we started chatting about them off, or I guess not offline, but outside the sessions. And at one point we decided, why don't we share some of these tools with the translation community? And we had, in particular, we'd attended a few sessions about Perfectit, which is a add-on for Microsoft Word that a lot of editors use. And it helps you kind of just streamline your editing process. It catches a lot of errors automatically that otherwise the editor would have to look for and change manually. It just saves a ton of time and catches all sorts of things that you wouldn't, that may not even occur to you. And yeah, and so we decided we wanted to share these tips with translators, and that's where the idea came from. I'm trying to think what else you asked. You said, what was the topic and why it's important to us? Yeah, so the topic was just, you know, tools, including Perfectit, that translators can use, borrowing from the editing profession, that will help translators be more efficient, because as we know, deadlines can be so tight for translators. And I would say the reason this is important to me is because I have a tendency of doing everything manually. I always, in my whole life, I've thought that if I do things, you know, slowly and manually, I'll catch everything and just be in better control of my work. And I've had to let go of that belief because in reality, it's, you know, we just don't have the time to do everything manually. And we have to trust in automated processes and being, you know, efficient in some way. And so I'm not a believer in obsessively automating everything and maximizing productivity, but I also think that we have to be, you know, it pays to be efficient and methodical in our work, and we can still have control. And that's why it's good to know the tools that are available to us to do that. And yeah, I think that's why it was important to me to share.
Yeah, and we also, like Emily was saying, we wanted to focus on kind of that interplay between the human approach and then also the automated. Like, I was recently reading a chain on Facebook, a discussion where somebody was asking about, just by chance, about perfected. And then somebody else was kind of, a lot of people said what, just kind of what Emily said, like there's things that you really, no matter how, kind of how, you know, detail oriented you are or whatever, it's just not possible to catch some of the stuff those things catch because it's this kind of automated process. Mm-hmm. It's a computer. Yay. Use the computers for what they're good for. But, somebody in that Facebook chain was like, you know, oh, I don't use anything like that because it makes it sound, you know, I don't know, canned or I don't know. And I thought, well, you don't really understand what that tool is then, because we weren't saying, and not, I wasn't even really in the conversation. I just kind of dropped in. But like in our presentation, we're mm-hmm. not saying, you know, yes, Perfectit will take over and do all your editing for you. It's not that at all. And I think some people maybe misunderstand tools that are available to them because it does really specific things and other tools like it, as opposed to, it's not, we're not saying like, oh yeah, that's interesting to me because it's like people thinking that, oh, translators just run it through and it's done. You know, they just run it through. We just take a translation and run it through some computer and then it's all done and we don't really do anything. I mean, that's not the case, obviously. And I think the people who think that a tool like Perfectit is doing the editing for you don't understand the tool, because that's not really how it works at all. I just wanted to point that out. So mm-hmm. in our presentation, we did emphasize the idea that there's a lot of things you can do from a human perspective too, like different checklists or different things that you do with your own eyes and your own organization. Mm-hmm. But then you want to pair that with these other things that kind of boost you up and make your proofreading and your editing even better, and recognize the tools for what they can offer to you.
Exactly, because imagine, for example, one of the things that Perfectit catches is acronyms that you haven't defined, or double spaces between a period and the next sentence, mm-hmm. or trying to think of what else. Nothing else comes to mind at the moment, but there are things that you would have to do manually in such a way that might be impossible or just so time consuming that it's not worth your time. You know, you could have a checklist that says check for all acronyms or control find for double spaces and correct them. But the more things are on your list, the more time it takes, and Perfectit will run and find all of that for you. So it's not doing your job so much as it's just taking a lot of manual things off your plate. And you are always in control of telling the program what you want to fix and where. It's mm-hmm. not like it just runs and changes the document automatically for you. You're always saying yes or no to every process.
Mm-hmm. Right. And that's something too, and we emphasize, like, you're always the one that, you know, you're ultimately responsible. And I think back to years ago, I taught French at a college course in French, and somebody turned something in and said, oh, well, the spell checker didn't catch it. And I thought, well, no, you didn't catch it.
Yeah.
I mean, in the like that same idea, you're using the tool, but it's not it was a homonym or something. And the person thought, well, it didn't catch it. And I thought, no, you didn't catch it because you're ultimately responsible.
Yeah.
So like you're saying, Emily, you know, it's just a tool. We still make the decision, the final decision.
Yep. That's another thing Perfectit catches is common misspellings, like rain, R-E-I-N versus rain, R-E-I-G-N. Mm-hmm. Things like that we may not even be aware of are mistakes, and the spell checker isn't going to catch that for you.
Yeah.
And actually, just speaking of the tools too, I think it's different that, you know, like some people complain, like just going back to the Facebook people, where I'm thinking like, you know, Word sometimes, sometimes the Word will give me, you know, if I run the different quality checks that Word offers us, which you still should do. But sometimes I just kind of giggle at those because they're kind of unsophisticated, I think, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think like that's the same idea. Like if someone thought like, okay, well, Word told me I should do it, I guess I have to take that suggestion, when obviously it's not right for that. That, you know, I mean, and it does have some good checks, you know, with spelling and different things, but then a tool like Perfectit takes it to the next level. And Perfectit isn't necessarily, I'd say that's more, let's see what you think, Emily, if it's more a QA tool or a proofing tool than an editing tool in a way. Like to me, editing would be like stylistic or something like that, which is sometimes what Word tries to do, you know, MS Word, and then that's usually not that helpful in Word. Like we usually end up ignoring those, right? So.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I'm one of those translators that often struggles with editing and proofreading part, because I feel like no matter how much time, unless it like several days have passed, I find myself still in that creative mode thinking about my translation, that I just keep like tweaking that part rather than focusing on, you know, the editing and proofreading steps. So I really need a really good checklist and a process, and that's something I need to improve. So what are some things that you think or notice translators usually struggle with when it comes to checking and improving their own texts as well as editing other people's work? Let's start with you this time, Eve.
Yeah, I just think it is super hard to proofread your own work for sure. And you know, often our eyes see what we originally meant to write, or what we, you know, and not what's actually there. So it is very difficult. So I think you know, you do need to take specific steps, whatever, you know, we can talk about some of those, but whatever they might be, so that you can see your work kind of, I always say, like, as if I were someone else, or as if it was a third party's work instead of my own work. So, you know, some of the tricks people probably are familiar with, but like, you know, changing the font, printing it out, giving yourself some time to come back to it, if it's possible in our kind of hurried daily, you know, lives or whatever. And then also, things, I think, when you're checking your own work or someone else's work, like we talked about, having specific checklists, and that sounds, you know, oh, okay, checklist, whatever. Emily was kind of teasing me because I'm like really into the checklist, and I set them up in OneNote, and you can do whatever you want. You could set them, print them in Word or whatever. I like using OneNote is the Microsoft note-taking tool, because you can do little check boxes, and so then as I go through them, I reuse them, and then I can also maybe have different ones for different clients or different types of subject matters, and then I can copy them and make new ones, you know, in different little pages within the notebook or whatever. And then also I use the checks to check them off, and then I can clear all the checks, and then, you know, next time I do the next one, then I check them again.
That's great.
So I kind of like that, but I think that I've really honed those down, like, oh well, for this client, you know, this issue comes up a lot. So for this client, it doesn't really. So I picked that off the checklist or whatever. You start with something and then kind of customize it for everybody. So I think that's important for your own work and things that you know that maybe you make a mistake doing. Not you particularly, Veronica, but you as in anyone in general. You know, if we're aware of some, you know, my own self, I think, oh yeah, sometimes I do X, you know, so then I add that to the checklist. Or this client often has, you know, when they send me files to be edited, this is a problem or whatever. So I think that too can really help you catch things that you might otherwise miss in your own work or in other people's works too. So another thing that I think is important is whether it be your own work or someone else's, is taking several passes for different types of things. So, you know, you're thinking, oh, I'm going to be editing for punctuation. Do a pass for that so that you're really focused on that. Oh, now I need to edit specifically for grammar, and, you know, do a pass for that. I'm editing for consistency because I noticed that sometimes the different word was used for this thing when it should have been the same. So, I mean, maybe you don't need to do one every single time, but you can batch them together in types of things that you're looking for that are similar. So you do want to go through several, at least I do. I know some people approach it slightly differently, but I think that that helps to, and actually one of the presentations that we saw with ACEs, like Emily mentioned, somebody had said once, you know, they don't do that. And then I think it must be more an approach, like what works for different people's minds, the way your mind works. But I think that's always been really helpful to me, to really think, okay, this time I'm checking numbers, this time I'm checking terminology, and not to mix it all together in a big catch-all, because I think that, at least for me, I miss more things that way.
Yeah, that's really helpful.
Yeah. And then the last thing I want to talk about in that is when editing other people's work, I think that people indeed struggle with the idea of making preferential changes. And I think that kind of muddies the waters. Like, it's a really specific task, and it isn't your role to make preferential changes. You know, I just thought that sounded better or whatever. And I know, and then even preferential changes, that phrase in and of itself, has, you know, what does that mean? Preferential changes. Yeah. You know, we could have a whole podcast on that. But I mean, I think it's really important for people when you're editing someone else's work to think, is there really a reason behind that change? And by that, I mean, is there a solid grammatical reason, a terminological reason, a stylistic reason, you know, a client-directed reason, a usage reason? You know, then go for it. But if there isn't, then don't take the risk of inserting errors and spending your time doing it and other people's time having to review it when it truly is only preferential. Mm-hmm. So I think that's something really important to keep in mind, too. When doing professional editing, you know, when you said when the idea of when we are looking at other people's work.
Yeah, right. That's great. Thank you so much, Eve. What about you, Emily?
I would say the thing that I think most translators struggle with when it comes to checking their own texts is just the lack of time. Because as we know, as I mentioned before, there's such tight deadlines in our profession with so many of our clients. And sometimes I think that the problem is actually that we don't ask for enough time, because sure, some clients do have tight deadlines, but I think as a collective, we tend to give in to their expectations that we'll turn things around really quickly and we don't advocate for the time that we actually need to provide the quality that we can provide, and also for our own well-being. You know, I think time is our greatest resource when it comes to catching errors and doing a good job. And a lot of the time we just don't have enough of it to do the job that we want to do. And, you know, I find that having a fresh pair of eyes is the, you know, most important thing for me when it comes to reviewing a text. And we all know the more you stare at it and the longer you spend staring at it that same day, the less you're going to catch any errors. And that's just, you know, that's just a fact. No matter how much you try to distance yourself from the text, there are just things you're going to miss. And there are tricks we can use to try to overcome that. And those are some things we mentioned in our presentation that we can touch on again today. But I think the best thing we can do is advocate for more time whenever possible. And one rule I try to stick to for myself is to make sure that I'm submitting a project at least one day after I finish the project, so I have a fresh day to look at it with a fresh pair of eyes. But even that, I just think, isn't really enough time to get the distance we need to see the errors.
Thanks for talking about that, by the way, because I don't know. I think a lot of people just think we have to accept the deadlines that clients give us and not, you know, negotiate deadline at all. And I think that that's partly our fault. So thank you for saying that, Emily. I think that's a really important point and maybe a smart habit, if you will. Yeah. But anybody who's ever had a text edited by Emily knows, I think I've called you before the eagle eye. She really does have an eagle eye. She will catch everything. So it's amazing. Yeah, that's a good point.
I was going to say, too, the same thing, Madeline, is that thank you for bringing that up, because I've said that for years, actually, that I think we're sometimes the, not as individually, but the area, the industry as a whole, we're our own earth. Our own worst enemy, in that we say, oh, yeah, I can do that really fast. Mm-hmm. And that people aren't expecting that. They don't necessarily expect it. And then we kind of make them expect it because they weren't thinking that in the beginning.
Right. Or we've had some clients that did expect it. So we just think, well, all clients prefer that, right? Or that's just the way we work. We work on tight deadlines, you know, and it's not necessarily, it doesn't have to be that way.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can't see me, but I'm nodding emphatically over here.
Okay. Good. Well, so let's talk about something else that's kind of interesting. And let's talk about feedback, a crucial element in improving our translation skills, but maybe not always something fun to think about. Sometimes people get nervous when they receive feedback, and feedback can also make some translators doubt their skills or become defensive. We've all seen this before, I'm sure. So do you have any advice on giving objective, constructive feedback, as well as receiving feedback and responding to it? Eve, what do you think about that?
Yeah, that goes back to what I was saying too. It's kind of related, you'll see, to what I was just saying about, you know, when you're editing, don't try to just edit for edit's sake. Like, it's really a specific thing you're doing, a specific task from a professional perspective. And so this is related to what I'm going to say here. So I feel like when you're giving feedback, which could be editing, right? It could be actually, you know, writing out a note, hey, I want to give you some feedback. But I mean, we're talking about it in this context of editing, proofreading. So when you're doing that and you're giving it, that feedback, you want to try to be neutral and factual, I think, with your comments. So I think just really just being factual is super helpful. So you state or you make the suggested change. And then if, you know, sometimes we give reasons for it and sometimes we don't, right? But if you're giving a reason for why it was made, then you cite the specific grammar rule, you cite the style guide or other, and I put in my notes in big letters, factual reason why you're making the change. And so don't, you know, insert any emotion into the comments that you make, thinking about, you know, it could go back to the person who actually did the translation or wrote the original monolingual text or whatever.
It does. It often does go back to that person.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. So, you know, and somebody might be thinking, well, nobody would ever do that. People do it all the time.
Yes, they do.
Yeah, making kind of emotional or snide comments. So I think, and I think it's more in our minds when we think the client might see it that we try to do that, but I think we should always do that, keep it really professional. And then, and again, like I said before, just only make changes that you really need to make the text better, you know, not anything preferential. And then in receiving, I think if you're receiving the feedback, take or leave the suggestions as you can. You don't have to take every suggestion all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, sometimes you might if it comes through a certain, like an agency or something, I don't know. But a lot of times, even then, you have the ability as the original person that originated the document to say, well, actually, I don't agree with that one because blah, blah, blah. Or sometimes a lot of clients will say to me, just take, you know, here's the feedback, finish it, you know, finalize it and take or leave what you need. Mm-hmm. So don't take things personally. And also, I think it's really important to appreciate that a good editor or a proofreader is making your text even better, and you should be excited by that. You know,
that's like, true.
And as an editor, that's what I feel excited by. Like, I like getting stuff that's already well translated or well written because then it's super fun. You know, yeah. I think, well, our goal together as a team is to make something that's really well written and exciting, and you should be excited by that. So if you're resistant to suggestions, think about why are you resistant? Is it because you feel insulted or angry? Or is it because the change actually doesn't improve the text, or the reason that they cited for the change isn't correct? So you want to look at the feedback that you get from that same, again, all uppercase factual point of view, and do it in a professional way, and ask yourself, you know, will this indeed make the text better? And if so, then happily accept it.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking the other day as I was reading a book, and I thought, people always give the author, of course, the praise, you know, for books, but what a lot of people don't realize is how much work an editor does behind the scenes to make that book what it is. And it's true that it's difficult for people to receive feedback, but
it's super
that's what makes
you say
it
that
better.
Too. Yeah, and I think it's interesting too because, well, there's a lot of wonderful self-published books out there too, but sometimes I'll be reading a book and I'll think, because it's kind of tedious to read, and it's usually nonfiction, but I don't usually read self-published fiction books, but like I remember reading this one book and I thought like, oh, this is kind of tedious. And then I thought, did this guy self-publish?
Did they have an editor?
Yeah, and he had, and I thought, because he didn't have an editor, exactly what you're saying. Like I thought an editor, unless someone's really, really gifted out of the norm of most of us, you need an editor. And that's, I just thought that was super interesting where I thought like, oh, okay, I could tell it was self-published before I even confirmed it because it was just kind of tedious and they needed an editor.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. What about you, Emily? What are your thoughts about giving and receiving feedback?
I love this question and just want to comment on what Eve just said about knowing that the book she was reading was self-published, perhaps without an editor. I just wanted to say that, you know, having an editor doesn't mean that we're not a great writer, all it is, or that the editor knows best or the editor knows better, or, you know, that they have some special skill that we don't have. Although of course they do have different skills in some ways, different knowledge, but it's really just a second pair of eyes, the value of having someone else read what we've written. And because we can't see what we've written from a new perspective, it's so hard to do that because all the ideas are in our head and we wrote it. And having another person look at it and say, oh, this, you know, this could use a better explanation, or what do you mean by this? That's so crucial. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, going to back to your question about receiving feedback or also giving feedback is just recognizing that you're not receiving feedback because you're not good enough or because you've done something wrong. You're receiving feedback because communication is really, it's about getting a message out to all sorts of different people and to people outside of yourself. And that requires some collaboration and some perspective that you can't get on your own. And I think that for me personally, receiving feedback was very difficult for most of my life because I'm a perfectionist and I struggled with with the idea that I was doing something imperfectly receiving feedback would count as doing something imperfectly because it made me think there was something inherently wrong with me. And I had to have another mindset shift. Like I've been talking about a few mindset shifts I've had throughout this conversation. And one of those was reading this quote from Brené Brown, who I'm sure some or most of you and your listeners are familiar with. And she said, healthy striving is self-focused. How can I improve? Perfectionism is other-focused. What will they think? And that just, that really struck a chord with me. Like for me, my perfectionism was about the fear of being not good enough or thinking other people didn't like me. And it dawned on me that wasn't what mattered. What mattered was being happy with myself and feeling like I was doing something valuable. And yeah, mm-hmm. everything changed for me in that moment. And ever since then, when I receive feedback from a client, I'm, like Eve said, I'm excited because it's a way for me to just do my job even better. And how could I know how to do it better if all I did was look at my own perspective? And you don't always have to agree with the feedback that you're given, but I think that receiving it is an opportunity and not a reason to be defensive or to feel like you've done something wrong. So that's kind of what came to mind for me and about receiving feedback. And as far as giving it, like Eve said, same thing I was going to say is only make changes if you can justify them based on an objective source, an authoritative source, like a style manual, a dictionary, and not just because you think it sounds better, as much as you might think you could phrase it better. It's important to cite actual objective reasons for the change. And mm-hmm. also to just be to be kind in your feedback, because ultimately when people have written something, whether it's a translation or their own work, original work, they have some sort of attachment to it. It becomes a part of their identity, and saying something in a condescending way or a critical way it can be really hurtful for them. And, you know, regardless of what I was just saying about the perfectionism and having a hard time receiving feedback, I think everyone deserves to have a helpful editor or a helpful reviser. And one way to do that is to use phrases like, you might consider XYZ, or what do you think of? And then, you know, adding another way of phrasing it or a different idea and explaining why. There's just, you know, there's kind ways of putting it. And I think that, yeah, some people can just put their thoughts down on the page in a way that can be, yeah, jarring for the writer or translator.
Yeah. And usually the snarky comments don't actually solve anything.
Exactly. Because then everyone just gets emotional.
Everybody's just upset at that point.
Exactly. Yeah, emotion doesn't need to be a part of it.
Right. Okay. So switching gears a little bit, what would you both suggest as far as any tools and resources that would help translators with quality control of their work? We sort of talked about Perfect It and, you know, a couple other things, but Emily, what do you think are some good tools and resources that every translator should have?
Oh, so many things come to mind, but one that has really stuck with me is looking at the text in a different format, especially if you're short on time. And one way I learned this was I recently translated an article for Eater that got published before we really finished the editing step because some people were on vacation. And then when it got put online, there were some long story, but there were some changes that happened that didn't get approved by me or the author. And I noticed these issues only because I was looking at the published article on my phone because I happened to be on vacation at the time when it got published. And I thought, oh, wow, how did I miss these? Some of the errors were things that I had introduced and I just completely, they went over my head. I didn't catch them and neither did the editor. And it just occurred to me that, you know, when you look at the text in a totally different format, it completely changes your perspective on it. So, you know, you could, since then I've kind of recreated this tactic by either sending myself the document in a Word document or a PDF and then opening it on my phone to read it that way. Or you can even just create a skinny column in Word, for example, and print it or look at it on your screen. And it just shifts where the words are located. And especially if you change the font, it really helps you to see things from a new perspective and catch errors you didn't see before or things you just want to phrase differently.
Oh, that's a great tip. I never thought about that. Cool. Eve, what about you? What kind of tools or resources would you suggest?
Yeah, for me, I have really got into text-to-speech because I think that also, for me, it helps me. Sometimes I don't even look at it as it's reading. Sometimes I do, but sometimes I don't because I feel like it's a different kind of input, kind of like Emily said in a slightly different way. Like you're changing it up totally, it's reading it to me. And I just use the Microsoft Word and or Microsoft Office, actually. You can do it in other applications besides Word too, but I usually do it in Word. There's two different ways you can do it in Word, and it's pretty easy to set up. And even though the voice is somewhat robotic, I like it because then I feel like it makes me, I like you. No, I feel like it, I mean, it's not super awful, and it makes me focus really on what it's saying. And so I catch a lot of stuff that way. Like I'll be like, oh, I did leave off the S on that word, and I wouldn't have seen that if I was just kind of looking through visually. And then often when I make an edit, when I've heard it, read it to me, then I'll fix that section and I'll have it read it to me again. Or, you know, so that I make sure, like, oh, as I was implementing the change, I didn't make another typo or whatever, you know. It's especially if it's moving things around or, you know, maybe not if I just added an S back in, but if I just, like Emily was saying, if I decided I want to rewrite that section, then I would, you know, visually look at it, but I'd also have the text-to-speech read it to me again. And I do it in sections. Like, you can try to do it, you know, all at once, but you can highlight the different sections. So I'll highlight, like, you know, three sentences at a time. And then I'll, you know, think, okay, because so I can really focus on those three sentences or that paragraph, because if you highlight the whole thing, it'll read the whole thing. You can stop it, but it just seems like there's always something, so there's no point in highlighting you know 3,000 words because you're going to be stopping soon. So I really like that. And then another thing I was just saying, just, you know, make sure that you invest in style guides or usage guides for your languages, and either electronically or on you know, hard copy, which I have some of those still because I like to use those that way. But that too, you know, so you have a reference to think to yourself, well, what is the reason? Or, you know, I think it sounds right, but am I actually right? No, is it really supposed to be this way? So you want to have the access to style guides, you know, professional ones or usage guides that you can actually check what your instinct is and make sure that it is factual what you're changing things to.
Oh, I love those tips. I'm learning so much. All right. Even Emily, you shared some wonderful tips about the smart habits that have helped in your career earlier in this conversation. But we wanted to ask you specifically about work-life clarity, the term that we prefer rather than saying work-life balance. We think it's extremely important for freelance language professionals. So what are your thoughts on this? And how do you try to protect the boundaries between your work and personal life? Let's start with you, Eve.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. And I just think this is something kind of that's been more in my mind lately. I mean, it always is. But just lately, I think I've been doing a good job of it, where I try to, you know, give it my all during the professional, the hours that are devoted to professional work. And then I try to put time limits and really stop at the end of the workday. That's what I've really been trying to do lately, because I just feel like it gives me this really good mental break, and it helps me to come back fresh when I'm starting work the next day. You know, I want to do the right thing for the professional viewpoint, and I also want to do the right thing for my family. And I could, you know, I would feel like there's always more work we could do. We could work 24 hours a day if we wanted. There's always more stuff to do. And so I feel like, okay, like somebody mentioned earlier, drawing a line. I just feel like, okay, I have to draw that line. And the line is, you know, what I decided my line is, whatever it is, you know, X PM in the evening, and I'm done. And so I feel like that's more productive for me from a mental health standpoint, and also from a long-term productivity standpoint. Because I think, Emily, you mentioned, like, you know, if we try to shove in too much stuff editing, then we don't see stuff. That's the same idea. Even if I think, oh, I'm going to keep working, I'm really not that productive anyway. So I really want to try to make everybody happy and make myself happy, but do really have this line and maintain those limits, the line between professional and personal life.
That's great. What about you, Emily?
Yeah, I completely agree with Eve about, you know, the more we work, the less effective or efficient we are. And for me, you know, when I started out freelancing, I had this idea that the more I worked, the better I would do. And I found myself working evenings and weekends. And it got to the point where that was my whole life. And I became known as the person who just worked all the time, and people could no longer rely on me to keep plans or to even have a life outside of work. And it got to the point where I realized I kind of needed an intervention. And at that point, I really took a step back and said, okay, weekends are for me, evenings are for me, and I need to have a life outside of work and really protect this time that's just for me. And as we all know, working as freelancers, our work is such a huge part of our identity. And I think something that's been helpful for me is to think about who am I? What other identities do I have outside of my work? Because I've gotten so tied up in this being who I am. And I liked the, someone posed the question to me of, you know, exactly what I just said, what are your identities outside of work? And thinking of it that way of, I, you know, defining these parts of me that have nothing to do with my work really helped me to see myself as a whole person. And that also helps me to respect the time that I spend doing things outside of work as just as important to my identity as work itself. And yeah, I think it's just, yeah, it's important to think of ourselves as whole people in that way.
Oh, that's so, such a healthy way of thinking and such a, an important reminder because, you know, I was, Veronica and I talk about this a lot here, is that we love our work. So it's easy to just keep working, right? Just keep going.
Exactly.
Yeah. Good. Very good tips. Well, thank you both for your excellent tips today. Yeah. I mean, I was just like thinking the whole time, like some of these things are just great new ideas and some of them are just wonderful reminders. So thank you. Before we wrap up, we'd love it if you join us for a special segment. We like to ask our guests to share something with our listeners about, say, a favorite book, a tool, or resource. We call this segment Guest Favorites. So is there anything that you would like to recommend? Emily, we'll start with you.
Yeah, I do. I recommend that book, Do Pause, that I mentioned earlier by Robert Poynton, I believe was his name. I didn't actually intend to bring up that book, but it came to mind. So that goes to show how much of an effect it had on me. And then a book that I did have in mind that I wanted to share that I'm actually reading right now, and I'm only about halfway done. So come back and ask me how it was when I finished. But so far, I found it really helpful. It's called The Happiness Trap. And the subtitle is How to Stop Struggling and Start Living. And this book talks about, the author describes techniques used in acceptance and commitment therapy, which the acronym is ACT, A-C-T. And it's a mindfulness-based mode of therapy that helps people to overcome recurring anxieties or fear and stress in their lives. And it's been a little bit revolutionary for me, the techniques that the author describes, because they seem so simple. And yet I've been practicing them and they really help me disconnect, or the term that he uses is defuse, from these beliefs that I've had my whole life. And they kind of, some of the tactics seem a little bit silly almost, but they actually, I found that they actually work. And the premise is that all humans are programmed to have negative thoughts, that we naturally think of negative things, because the way that we have evolved is we evolved in a way where we had to be alert to dangers and threats and anything that could go wrong. And so we are just designed to obsess about the negative. And he, the author, talks about how these thoughts are so, they occur so often, and yet they're completely unhelpful. Like believing negative things isn't going to help us actually get anywhere. And so the book helps you to not control, the idea isn't to control your thoughts, but to actually accept them. And by accepting them and thanking your mind for pointing those things out to you, research has shown that it actually helps us to let go of them, or to not become so consumed by them as we do when we try to stop ourselves from thinking those thoughts.
It like neutralizes them. Yeah.
And then and the whole idea is to only keep the thoughts that are helpful, helpful and true, I think is the way he puts it. And the ones that are unhelpful or false, you have to just accept that they'll be there, but that you don't need to focus on them because they're not going to get you anywhere.
Oh, yeah, that's really helpful. I think that's helpful to anybody at any, you know, time in their life when they're feeling like they need a little reset.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, Eve, what about you? Do you have a favorite to share?
Yeah, mine is a book too. I have just, I'm almost done. I think I have like 30 pages left in Trevor Noah's book that's called Born a Crime. And he talks about, Emily and I were discussing actually before we started recording, that he doesn't talk about his life as a comedian or his life as a celebrity type person at all. But I think Part of it, I was like, oh, tell me how you became famous too. But I think that the purpose of his book wasn't that at all. And I don't usually read that kind of book anyway. But what he talks about instead is his life as a child and a young man under apartheid, and then the immediate post-apartheid period in South Africa. And mm-hmm. his mother was a black woman and his father was a white man. And at the time, as you may have figured out, the why he says he was born a crime is because it was a crime to be born of a mixed couple. And he, and it's super interesting, and it's, it's very engaging, and he's a funny guy, but it's not like nonstop yucks or anything. I mean, but it's still, it is humorous at times, and it's engaging, and it's very moving. And also it's thought provoking. To me, it was about how we see others in the world and how we can empathize with them, which I think I do. You know, I try to live my life like that, but then, then I was like, oh, he still had things where I thought like, okay, I didn't think about that way. Or, so that was super interesting and helpful to me. Yeah. And so that was the book, Trevor Noah's book, Born a Crime.
Wonderful. Both of them sound like great additions to my wish list. Mm-hmm. So Emily and Eve, thank you so much for joining us today. We really enjoyed talking to you, and I'm sure that our listeners will also find your tips on improving the quality of our translations and your smart habit tips very helpful. So before we go, where can our colleagues learn more about you or find you online?
Yeah, I'd say the easiest place to find me is my website, which is saffrontranslations.com. Saffron like the spice.
Yeah, me too. It's bodeinternational.com. And then I think you guys will put it in the show notes. And then also on Twitter too, and it's ebodeu, my Twitter handle.
Yes, we'll definitely add those to the show notes. So thank you both. And to our listeners, we encourage you to join Eve's book club for translators called Global Reads. We really enjoy being a part of it, and membership is free. You can find the link to the book club in the show notes for this episode on our website. And before we wrap up, we wanted to let you know that Emily is generously sharing a free copy of her presentation on how translators can add copy editing to their services, and Eve is sharing 10 tips for an ergonomic office. So if you'd like to receive these freebies from Emily and Eve, sign up for our email list. Our email subscribers will receive these next week, as well as the links to other resources we mentioned in the email for this episode. And if you're not yet receiving our emails, please go to our website and sign up at smarthabitsfortranslators.com. Thanks again for joining us, Eve and Emily.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. So that's it for our conversation today. If you like this episode, there are a couple of simple ways you can show your support. Please share it with your colleagues and friends and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. This only takes a minute, and we have recorded a quick video tutorial to show you how to do it. We'll link to it in the show notes.
Talk to you soon.
We hope you enjoyed this episode and discovered some simple strategies that you can apply today at work or at home to help you achieve the lifestyle you desire. If you did, please let us know. We'd love to hear from you.
If you have a topic you want us to cover, please send us a message at hello@smarthabitsfortranslators.com. If you like this episode, we'd appreciate if you'd leave us a review wherever you listen to podcasts. And please share the podcast with other translators you know.